The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is Monday, January 13th, 2014. Thanks for joining me on tonight's program, which is focused still on the very costly fallout or the intolerable cost, ongoing cost, of the Holocaust. First, I want to thank Charles for his two donations today, too. And Charles is a nice friend of a good friend of ours, and we're very appreciative to him for that. And I also got a message from someone in Hungary, Zombek, Hungary. He even sent me his telephone number. And his name is Attila Levay, L-E-V-A-Y. You know, I've noticed I've had two correspondents named Attila from Hungary, so I assume Attila is a pretty common or popular name in Hungary. We usually think of that as being from somewhere in the past, you know, but it's still being used. Certainly is a nice, strong name. Now he writes, instead of harassing, persecuting, and imprisoning people who want to study and perhaps raise questions about the currently official, in quotes, and unalterable, in quotes, version of the Holocaust, a disinterested body of historians should be set up to research and evaluate all the available evidence without harassment and hindrance. Well, he's not the first one to come up with that idea. Actually, Kevin Barrett once suggested it, thinking he had a real good idea there. But the problem is the historians are not able to be disinterested because of a Jewish control over academia. And they don't want to get into this real historians who would do a proper job of it, because they would come up with the same thing the revisionists have come up with, and then they'd be in big trouble. So they stay away from it. They don't touch. If you have noticed, real historians who have PhDs in history and are professors in universities and so on, except for a few Jews who have these positions, like Ken Walzer and a few others, and they're actually there for that purpose. They were promoted and so on and given their plum jobs for that purpose. But almost all historians don't ever write about the Holocaust. It's not a subject they want to even touch. And if they write about World War II, they also stay away from Holocaust, except just, you know, acknowledging it. So this is not a solution, unfortunately. The problem is that the world will not look at this thing in a disinterested manner. And, you know, I want to also say that Kevin Barrett's friend and sidekick and partner in some endeavors, Jim Fetzer, has denied categorically that he's ever seen any Jewish control in the university system. He always talks about how he's, you know, he's a professor and he's retired from University of Minnesota, and he has quite a nice I'm saying things I'm not prepared for here. What do you call that when they have that? I keep forgetting that anymore. Anyway, he has a nice resume of all his contributions, and he talks like he's an expert on everything to do with the academic world. And he says there's never seen any Jewish control, and he doesn't believe that that's the case. So there's something wrong there with Jim Fetzer, I've always thought. There's something not very scientific in the way that he discusses things. Now, Attila goes on, in the terrible world that we all live in, he says, it is repulsive and unacceptable that anyone should claim exclusiveness or unique priority for their interpretation of any historical event. And he goes on a bit. I'm not going to read all of this because we're all pretty familiar with it. you know, he says these people think they're special, and that's the problem. And 70 years after it's supposed to have taken place, he's referring to Holocaust, we're still wallowing in this overbearing, schmaltzy, arrogant self-pity and so on. But then, towards the end, he says, and today, in every sense of the word, American Jewry is the richest, financially most powerful, and most successful Jewry in the world. This fact is often proudly proclaimed and boasted about by the Israeli leaders themselves. Excuse me. In reality, it is probable that this is only an extension of their distorted, self-opinionated, chosen people type of complex. Eventually, the truth will come out, he says, regardless. The truth will come out regardless. This is his final statement. The truth will come out. It would be in the interest of all of us that it should take place in an atmosphere of tolerance and understanding. Well, you know, I have to disagree with Attila in this. After all that's happened in all these 70 and 75 years, or let's say 70 years, there's no room for tolerance and understanding for the people who put us all through all of this. So I'm sorry to say, that's not what I wish for, but I do wish that the truth will come out and that it would be accepted. And, that's what I think it can happen, and that's what I'm working towards. So, and this what this program is about. So let's continue on a couple little news events before I get into my main topics, that I just wanted to mention. That for some nationalist parties in Europe, Bulgaria, I saw just let's see, on the 10th, they have a nationalist party in Bulgaria. It's called ATAKA, and a group of them, maybe their entire party, that are in the capital of Sofia. Not a whole lot of them, but a nice turnout. They had a pretty nice turnout there. They were protesting outside the U.S. embassy in Sofia, the capital, on the 70th anniversary of an Allied bombing raid, which took place in 1944. And they want, there's a monument in Sofia that honors U.S. airmen who died in the war, in action over Sofia. And they want that monument removed. They say it's humiliating. There's also a monument nearby to Bulgarian airmen. And I think they consider it humiliating because it appears, it makes out that Americans did the fighting for Bulgarian, maybe, or that they owe something to these United States airmen for helping them out because they were bombing their city. obviously bombing the Germans must have been there. The Wehrmacht must have been there, some troops and so on. Anyway, that's good for them. And, you know, in the pictures I saw of them, they look very nice. They're really a nice-looking group of white people, just like you'd see anywhere. Then in Estonia, way up north from Bulgaria, in Tallinn, their capital, there was news from there, too, on January 10th, which was that the nation, the government, granted a burial with full military honors to a decorated Nazi, they call him, SS veteran, who distinguished himself in combat against Soviet troops during World War II. His name was Harold Nugasek. He was the last surviving Estonian recipient of Nazi Germany's Knight's Cross. He won the highest award Germany gives out, the Knight's Cross. And when he died on January 2nd, he was 93 years old. Now this article, this news story comes out of Russia, the RIA Novosti. I think that's a Russian news service. And so it adds here, the history of Estonian collaboration with the Nazis is a subject of widespread revulsion in neighboring Russia, but it's viewed by many in the Baltic nations as having been necessary for achieving national independence. Well, they like to put it that way. But here was at the ceremony, it was attended by Brigadier General Milos Kylie, who is currently commander of the Estonian Defense League. Now, I'm not sure what that is. And other retired high-ranking military officers and local officials. And the Estonian Defense Minister, whose name is Rein Salu, earlier expressed condolences to the relatives of the deceased Nazi veteran, meaning the man named Nugasex, saying that Nugasex was a legendary Estonian soldier whose tragedy was that he could not fight for Estonia in Estonian uniform. Well, they have to talk like that. But anyway, they did bury him with honors, and the Russians are most unhappy about that, and probably, but the government stood behind it. What else is of interest here? Oh yeah, you know, after the war, he was in his division, whatever, surrendered in 1945, and he became a prisoner of the Soviets, and he was sent to Siberia, and wasn't returned until 1958. So from 1945 to 1958, the Russians had this man in Siberia, you know, and then these people are supposed to be, you know, grateful to the Soviets for what they did or be friendly toward them or whatever. Doesn't make much sense, but that was under Stalin, and now they're under others, and they want to forget about all that and have them be friends with, and have them be anti-Nazi like the Russians are. Okay, well, I'm going to start out here tonight with the Holocaust of as religion. I was talking with a little bit with Guillermo Rudolph yesterday, and it came up about this subject, you know, and there was he thinks it's important. And he brought up a book. I'll start there. Okay, he brought up a book that has been translated into English, and it hasn't been published yet. But they said they could publish it at any time. They just hadn't done so yet. And it's by Carlo Mattonio. The title translated into English, I'll just say it that way, is The Final Solution for Holocaust Peddlers, : On the Complete Failure of Mainstream Holocaust Historiography. And it has a part in it that talks about Holocaust as religion. And it says that several authors, especially the Italian writer Gian Antonio Valli, Gian Antonio, and then Valli is spelled V-A-L-L-I. He's not actually, he's a revisionist, but he's actually a medical doctor, and he's spoken out and has been persecuted quite a bit for it. But he likes to talk about, like, how the Holocaust has become a religion, and he says that present belief in the Holocaust, or Mattonio says that the present belief in the Holocaust is in effect a true blue secular religion, or it might be called a superstition rather than a religion, but or a secular religion, but I'd rather call it a secular religion. This belief has, and then he goes on and lists all these things in this book, you know, has its own crucifixion and what that is, and the Lamb of God and the own priests and so on. And I decided to rewrite this because it's all written as a long sentence, and it's kind of hard to follow that way. So I took all these things and I may have added one or two more, because I've got now 14 items that show that describe the religious significance of the what makes the Holocaust a religion, and taken from the Christian religion, really. So it's this a secular religion or superstition is mimicking Christianity, and it has its own. And the first one is crucifixion, the Jewish people as a collective Messiah or a collective Savior. You know, it's that all the Jewish people have been crucified. And in the same sense, the Lamb of God is brought in that the victims have been slaughtered by the Nazis, not just the crucifixion, but also the slaughtering they're always presented that way. And then that's two. Then number three, you have the priests, definitely, which should be seen as the Holocaust historians. And they do behave more like priests than historians, as I was kind of alluding to above in from Attila's email. And you could add some others besides just Holocaust historians, but I like to keep it simple. So I think that basically the priests are the Holocaust historians. And as I said, most of them are not even real historians, but that's what they're called. And then the Christian cathedrals and churches have been taken, that place has been taken over by the Holocaust museums and memorials in the Holocaust religion. And they really are like churches and cathedrals. They really are like holy places. And this Jan van Pelt, who is the current probably leading Holocaust historical writer, he has been quoted in an interview that's been videotaped. It's on YouTube. It's a long interview with him, and he was calling the crematorium two, the most famous crematorium in Birkenau, the Holy of Holies, and saying that it was just a terrible thing for people to go there and not prepare themselves properly for it. And of course you can't even go there because it's a destroyed structure. So you just go and look at ruins. But anyway, I think he was able to go down inside there, like the revisionists did earlier in time when nobody was watching them. I don't know if anybody could go down inside there. Now, they actually have it all roped off when I was there, but partly it was because they were doing this restoration work. So I don't know if they're going to keep it that way. But this Van Pelt said that he prepared himself for years. That's what he said. He prepared himself for years to go there so he would, you know, have the proper attitude, respectful attitude. And and he was complaining that this Fred Lucher, the revisionist, went in there without being prepared and just kind of desecrated the place, according to Van Pelt. So this is the attitude. And along with the Holocaust museums and memorials being holy places, they have the holy days, and there definitely are those, like the Day of Remembrance that comes in the spring is called Yom HaShoah. It's actually was begun in Israel for the Israelis' special day, and then the United States took it up. So we have that here too. In the United States, usually in March or April, because it's according to the Israeli calendar or the Judaic calendar. And then, of course, what's coming up soon, January 27th, is a big, big day and of Holocaust commemoration. And then they also have now they're making more and more of the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising and all these other lesser events that took place, are being recognized. And from there we go to the saints. Of course, Elie Wiesel is the first one who comes to mind, and he definitely is a saint of the Holocaust religion. And I was trying to think of some others, but I didn't have time to look any up because there are other more important things to spend my time on. So, but another one that comes to mind is this Israel Meyer Lau, who a lot is made of him because he was another young, he was a little boy in Buchenwald. Elie Wiesel was supposed to was 16 and 17, but this Meyer Lau was 4 years old. He was the youngest person at Buchenwald camp, and he was, of course, he was well taken care of, but his name was Joseph Schiffstein, something like that, and somehow he ended up there because his parents were there, and then later he was taken to Israel and brought up there, and, you know, after the liberation and all, and he became a famous rabbi in Israel. And I think he's retired now, but he's highly respected, and, you know, they make a big deal out of him. So he's another one of their saints, Meyer Lau. Well, of course, we've got, just comes to my mind now suddenly, Wiesenthal, Simon Wiesenthal, in spite of his terrible reputation as a liar, he's another saint. And there's quite a few more. But nobody is as big a saint as Elie Wiesel. Now, prophets, that we also have prophets, the eyewitnesses whose statements of what they saw cannot be questioned. And that's true. They're, you know, when the prophets were speaking, there's only, I think the only prophet of the New Testament is John the Baptist, but there were a lot of prophets in the Old Testament. In any case, when a prophet says things, nobody understands it at the time because it's something that no one can see but the prophet and the prophecy. But then it always turns out to be true. So in a sense, we have these eyewitnesses to the gassings and the torture and the this and that at the various camps and so on. And whatever they have said is accepted because it was like, it's like, well, they were there and they saw it and they of course wouldn't lie. And so we don't question any of it. They take the place of the prophets. Then there's also pilgrimages, which every religion has its pilgrimages. In this case, in the Holocaust religion, the pilgrimages are to the former German concentration camps. And I suppose you could come up with some burial grounds or something else too, but mainly they go to these, this is very much in the same sense of the cathedrals and churches, but you know, they go on their trips to these former concentration camp memorials, and they take it very, very seriously. It's like they're doing, you know, something they have to be very, very respectful to. And they go with an idea of total belief and total acceptance of what the place symbolizes and what it means. And then from there we go, we even have the Inquisition that we find in religions. And in this case, it's the media that enforces Holocaust orthodoxy. The media is definitely the functioning arm of the enforcing Holocaust orthodoxy, truly. And then since there's Inquisition, there's also excommunication. And we have that, especially it's well known, used to be in the Catholic Church. I don't know that they excommunicate people anymore, but they do excommunicate Holocaust heretics who don't believe what they're supposed to believe, and in a very strong way. In fact, you can use the word anathema. Anathema is pronounced against heretics, and they're banned and excluded from the tribe, and even in our society, they're excluded from all the benefits that they might otherwise be able to enjoy, like good employment and friendships and people speaking to them. Kevin MacDonald experienced something like this at his university, where he was excluded. And is still somewhat excluded and looked upon, you know, with all sorts of negative reactions by so many there. But he's had to put up with that, and so many others. I mean, everybody's had to put up with that who has come out openly. against what, not in his case, it wasn't about Holocaust, but it's just about Jews. Same thing, you know, it comes down to the same thing, anti-Semitism. And now there's even a prosecutorial arm in that secular laws and law courts that punish revisionist utterances, you know. So we have these laws and law courts that will uphold everything about Holocaust and punish those who go against it. And it's also religious zealots. Every religion has its zealots, and that's Z-E-A-L-O-T-S, friends. And so many religious zealots, but Mantegna and Graff brought up the French writer Albert Camus, who I didn't know that he was a Holocaust zealot, but I looked it up and read more about him, and turns out he was really, really gung-ho about Holocaust and how much he hated fascism and so on. He was one of the existentialists that were so fashionable in the 60s. And also, I come up with Abe Foxman. He's definitely a zealot, but there's a lot of others that could be named. And then at the final one, the faithful. That is, you know, the faithful flock. And these are the unquestioning believers of Holocaust propaganda. And that's what the faithful are. You go by faith. And I'm not trying to denigrate any of this when it's used properly, but I'm just making these connections. When you go by faith, you don't question. You don't question it. And it's okay, I suppose, you know, in a religious sense, it can be perfectly healthy. But in the sense of something like this, you know, you're accepting all of this and being unwilling to question it, because that would mean that you're not one of the faithful. You know, you're not accepting, you're not believing, and it's important to be a believer. So there we have the religion. Now, I at Counterpunch, I don't read Counterpunch anymore, but I just saw something a little while ago that was in the January 1st at the Counterpunch online, the website. And it has to do with the Shoah as religion, as a state religion in France. And I thought it was really interesting. I'm going to read it. It says, meanwhile, this is just from in the middle of it, you know, it's a long, long article. Meanwhile, another community is the object of constant solicitude. In the last 20 years, while religious faith and political commitment have declined drastically, the Holocaust, called the Shoah in France, has gradually become a sort of state religion. Schools commemorate the Shoah annually. It increasingly dominates historical consciousness, which in other areas is declining, along with many humanistic studies. In particular, of all the events in France's long history, the only one protected by law is the Shoah. So that's the only thing in France that is protected by law. The only thing that took place. And it says the so-called Gesso law bans any questioning of the history of the Shoah, an altogether unprecedented interference with freedom of speech. Moreover, certain organizations such as LICRA, LICRA, which is the International League Against Racism and Anti-Semitism, have been granted the privilege of suing individuals on the basis of incitement to racial hatred. And this is always against Jews. This is a Jewish organization, and so the racial hatred that they care about is always about Jews, you know, against Jews. So here you have just a Jewish organization that's allowed to sue individuals that they think are expressing racial hatred. And they are able to collect damages on behalf of the injured community. In practice, these laws are used primarily to prosecute alleged anti-Semitism or negationism concerning the Shoah, and those two things always go together. Even though they frequently are thrown out of court, such lawsuits constitute harassment and intimidation. And, you know, you don't want to have to be brought into court because you've got to prepare a court case, you've got expenses, so on. And it's a terrible interference in your life when that's done. It says, France is the rare country where the BDS, which is Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, that movement against Israeli settlements practices. In France, that also can be attacked as incitement to racial hatred. That boycott movement is allowed, I guess, in France to be criticized and even brought into a law court about over incitement to racial hatred. That's how seriously they take that. And we know with this Dieudonné business now, that's what's going on there. And it's very hot in France right now. I actually wrote to Vincent Renoir before the show and asked if he and Marie could come on my program on Saturday. I don't know if they will, if they'll be, you know, if they don't have something else going on or they can't do it. But I have asked them. It would really be nice if I could have them on Saturday and talk about all this, what's going on in France right now. There's a lot more been happening. In fact, I saw that some fans of Dieudonné had hacked into the websites, three very well-known websites, Jewish websites, and they named them and actually brought them down and put on messages in support of Dieudonné on their somebody's complaining to me about how I pronounce that word, and I'm sorry, I can't really do it any better. So they managed to do that, and that was a big deal. So there's a lot of support for this man, and it's stirring up a lot of things. So it's very, very good. This article goes on to say that I don't want to read all of it. I've got something else to read. But meanwhile, politicians flock, talking about how it is in France. Politicians flock to the annual dinner of the CRIF, another Jewish organization. This one is translated in English as Representative Council of French Jewish Institutions, and they have the same zeal in the United States they flock to the dinner of AIPAC, you know, same kind of thing. And they say not so much for campaign funds, but to demonstrate their correct sentiments. Also, it says the religion of the Holocaust has deeper political impact in France. More than anything else, Auschwitz has been interpreted as the symbol of what nationalism leads to. There's this person, a Jew, Bernard Henri Lévy, you know, L-E-V-Y with an accent on the E, the writer whose influence has grown to grotesque proportions in recent years, and he has said, they say, this writer says he led President Sarkozy into war against Libya. He began his career as an ideologue by claiming that fascism is the genuine French ideology. He wasn't saying that in a positive way. He was attacking France and the French people as being fascists, and that was their real ideology of France was fascism. And so the writer says, guilt. By placing Auschwitz as the most significant event of recent history, various writers and speakers justify by default the growing power of the European Union as necessary replacement for Europe's inherently bad nations. And, you know, it's all nationalism is bad. All nationalists are bad, and we don't want nation states in Europe anymore. We want one big united Europe under the European Union and really under the Jews and under the control of how the Jews want things to be. So, friends, you know, this just demonstrates more of the damage caused by Holocaust and why there's no way out except through the Holocaust. So I'm going to go now to back to Carlo Mattonio for a little while. And you know, I don't like to mix the Heretics Hour with the Saturday afternoon program, but I do it because I can't. I don't want to wait to continue on something that happened on one program on to the next one, and I don't want to wait a whole week and put something else in between when these things are on my mind. And as some of you are aware, at the end of Saturday's program, I was reading from Carlo Mattonio's newly translated article that hasn't been published yet. And it was, as I want to repeat again, that it's translated by Carlos Porter, who has been doing, who does so much great work in this field. And I got to the part, and right at the end of the program, about the bones. The bones and the use made of the bones and the human bones and the animal bones and the fables and the fairy tales that were made up about it. And I ended up saying, in essence, without meaning to, I don't think I meant to. Maybe I had a short circuit in my brain at that time. I do get these little short circuits, especially when I'm kind of pressured. And I made it sound like that the Germans were trying to extract grease from the bones, the human bones after cremation, which of course is nonsense because after you cremate a body, there's not going to be any grease in those bones, you know, even if there's some bones left. But in any event, I want to I wrote a comment about it to clear that up, and I want to go over this part again, and I will read as much as I can until the end of this hour when I'll go on to something else. It's very interesting. So I'm in the, let me go back up. I'm in the title of this article is 60 years, is actually it's 27 January 1945 to 27 January 2005. That's when he wrote it. It was at the anniversary of, it was when the, 27 January commemoration was first decided upon by the United Nations. And the rest of the title is 60 Years of Propaganda. And then after that, Origins, Development, and Decline of the Gas Chamber Propaganda Lie. He has the word lie there. So I'm starting now at what's called Section 2. And it is, the heading is The Lie of the Industrial Exploitation of Human Corpses. So I'm just going to read and comment as little as possible, because when I comment too much, I start saying things that get confusing. In the paragraph above, I reported the manner in which the eyewitness, KJ, if you recall him, described the Auschwitz lubricant factory. Studying the origins of this lie is important because it shows clearly the manner in which the Auschwitz propagandists elaborated upon their own fairy tales, starting with a particle of truth, but distorting it so as to invest it with a terrible criminal significance. This was the procedure utilized in creating the fairy tale of the gas chambers. Same procedure. The lie of the manufacturer of human soap was too juicy to avoid propagandistic exploitation, but since the propagandists lacked any sense of proportion, the successive developments of the tale degenerated into the grotesque and ridiculous. For example, the following tale was told by ex-Auschwitz inmate Olga Langiel. She said, this is quoted from her testimony, "The Nordic supermen knew how to profit from everything. Enormous barrels were used to gather the human fat, which melted at high temperatures, and it was not to be wondered at that the camp soap had a rather disgusting odor, and the inmates looked upon certain pieces of fatty sausage with suspicion." That's the end of her, of Olga. This tale, too, has now fallen into oblivion, although attempts are made to resurrect it from time to time. In 1994, a researcher from the Auschwitz Museum, Andrzej Strzelecki, declared, "There is no truth that human fat was used to make soap at Auschwitz, or that human skin was tanned to make lampshades, book covers, wallets, or other objects." But another fairy tale, no less grim, is incredibly still around, that of the exploitation of human bones. This accusation had already been made in the first Nuremberg trial by the Soviet prosecutor Smirnov. Now, the first Nuremberg trial, of course, was the one of the major war criminals with all the famous Nazis up there, you know, and that were hung, most of them, at the end of it, and all of the crazy testimony that went on and what was presented as to all the crimes that they had committed. And so Smirnov, the Soviet prosecutor, said, and now this is what is presented at Nuremberg by the Russians. From 1943, the Germans, in order to utilize the bones which were not burned, started to grind them and sell them to the firm Strem for the manufacture of superphosphates. In the camp, there were found bills of lading addressed to the firm Strem of 112 tons and 600 kilograms of bone meal from human corpses. The Germans also used for industrial purposes hair shorn from women who were doomed for extermination. And in the Auschwitz Museum, now that's the end of that, Matonia writes, and in the Auschwitz Museum's most important work, published at the end of 1990s, of, now, he said published at the end of the 1900s. I think that's an error. Maybe it's the 1990s, whatever it is. On the same Andrzej Strzelecki. No, this is the... Andrzej Strzelecki is the Polish person at the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial. He adds, quote, "According to the investigation of the Soviet War Crimes Commission, investigating crimes committed in Auschwitz concentration camp," that's the whole title of that, "the bones of the cadavers cremated were ground and then sold as bone fertilizer to the chemical industry Strem di Strzemieszki at Drobowa Górnicza in the region of Drobowa. The bones that were to be transformed into fertilizer. At least 100 tons of ground human bones were shipped to this industry from Auschwitz concentration camp between 1943 and 1944. Now, Matonio says the fairy tale, he calls this a fairy tale, was based on a list drawn up by a Polish inmate on 27 February 1945. That would have been 1 month exactly from the so-called liberation of Auschwitz. And he delivered, he found this list there, and he delivered it to the Soviet Commission. And, you know, the Soviet Extraordinary Commission, which was set up there to investigate all the crimes of the Germans. And it bears this list bears the heading, and it's in Polish, but it's translated, "List of French bones and osseous waste shipped to the Strem Company from Strzemieszki something station." Now that's the list. Fresh bones and osseous waste. And Matonio says the list inventories the materials shipped to this company with an indication of the date, carriage number, content, and weight. The contents column specifies in German the type of bone shipped. And I'm not going to try to say the German words. I'll just say it was fresh bones, animal waste, bovine bones, skins for making glue. Therefore, the bones, those four things, therefore the bones sent to the Strem company were not human bone, but animal bone. And if they say fresh bones, frische Knochen, that you're not going to have fresh bones after they've been cremated, right? So definitely this all refers to animal bones. Matonia writes, "Pursuing the investigation in greater depth, we can see that the origins of the lie of the use of human fat for industrial purposes, comes from there. We see that the origins are in this idea that they were sending these bones but they were sending animal bones, not human bones. Now, the slaughterhouse at Auschwitz camp, and let's remember, you see, Auschwitz camp had a slaughterhouse because they provided meat for the people there. And they provided meat for the prisoners, too, and the inmates, who were workers and so on. Of course, the camp personnel got meat, but the others got some meat, too, because they wanted to give them a diet good enough to keep them healthy and able to work and so on. So people who say that all they ever got was soup made out of grass or a few turnips or something like that are just wrong. They had a pretty good diet. Anyway, not great, but you know, the slaughterhouse at Auschwitz camp, as shown on an installation inventory dated 27 September 1944. When I say not great, I should be careful because some of them ate very well. And sometimes some of them in certain positions and so on had special privileges and, you know, to the kitchen and so on, and they ate very well. And they got a lot of food from Polish people outside the camp. And there was a lot of coming and going in that camp. And these people brought food in, Polish people who came to work in the camp, who were not inmates in the camp, and then left in the evening, they would bring stuff to give to their friends and so on. So these people were not starving in there at all. In fact, they were doing pretty well. So I don't know, revise that a little bit, what I just said. So, an installation inventory dated 27 September 1944 contained an installation for the extraction of grease from animal bones, which was installed as early as September 1942. The related device, called a Nockenentfettungsapparat, apparatus, had been supplied by the M. Trusted Company of Berlin, Hanover, as shown in a letter from the company management to the management of Auschwitz concentration camp, dated 25 June 1942. The installation was used to extract grease from animal bones to enrich the diet of the inmates, but for camp propaganda, it was transformed into an installation for the industrial exploitation of human fat. So he thinks that this process that they were doing and this apparatus they had to extract grease was got transformed into the lie that they were collecting human fat from cremated bodies and using it for industrial purposes. Matonia writes, it is worth noting that the British propaganda story of the corpse factory during the First World War, correctly turned by Arthur Ponsonby, as, quote, Ponsonby said later, one of the most revolting lies invented during the war, had a similar origin. The Times, for example, on 16th, you know, that's the London Times, on 16 April 1917, wrote that the German army had a corpse recycling plant in which the fat obtained from the bodies of fallen soldiers was transformed into lubricant oils, while the other remains were ground up into osseous flour, which was then mixed with food for swine. Now think about this one. They're saying that the Germans took the bodies of their fallen soldiers. Now, they must mean their own soldiers, own Germans, and transformed them into lubricant oils and also into flour for pigs to eat, to mix with pig food, swine food. Can you imagine feeding your own soldiers' bodies to swine? That is a horrendous lie, horrendous and revolting, just as this Ponsonby admitted. Now, as Walter Lacour, he's a Holocaust historian, wrote, there were, in fact, similar installations in Germany and called Cadaver where Vertum San Sultan, but they processed animal corpses because cadaver, spelled with a K in German, is an animal corpse, is the word for animal corpses, cadaver, and not the bodies of human beings, which is Leichen in German. And you know, the lichen keller, the lichen sellers in all, in, designated, you know, written for these morgues in the crematorium buildings. A lot of you will be familiar with that lichen keller. That was a place to store, to keep human corpses before you, were able to cremate them or do so, or bury them or something. So there's a difference there, in those wordings. And whenever they talk about cadaver, they're talking about animals. I didn't know that. I thought that was pretty interesting. Walter LeCour added, in the mid-1920s, Austen Chamberlain, the British Minister of Foreign Affairs, admitted in Parliament that the story of the corpse factory was without foundation. But now back to Metonio. But this sort of propaganda blooms afresh even today. One recent news item described the discovery of Israel. In Israel, the discovery in Israel of a box of soap supposedly produced out of Jewish fat, or supposed to have been produced out of Jewish fat, arousing the annoyance of the Yad Vashem Institute. One of their spokespersons has in fact declared that there is no proof that the Nazis made soap out of human fat during the Holocaust. See, even these institutes don't like these kind of rumors because they know they're ridiculous. So they're trying to get, they denounce them. They continue to go around, though, by the most, just by people who should know better. Other, no less revolting lies also circulated during the Great War, that is the First World War. LeCour notes, in March 1916, the Daily Telegraph reported that the Austrians and Bulgarians had killed 700,000 Serbs in gas chambers, that is, using poison gas. A few readers probably remembered this story when, in June 1942, the Daily Telegraph was the first to report that 700,000 Jews, the same number, this time Jews, not Serbs, had been gassed. That's pretty, you know, in the same newspaper. So he's saying that they, you know, they're repeating themselves. But a few resistance members at Auschwitz remembered this report even earlier than the Daily Telegraph towards the end of 1941. They were saying this at the end of 1941, they're saying so. Now he goes on, birth of the propaganda lie of the gas chambers. The story of the gas chambers was born rather early on, but with a highly specific connotation. Experimentation with toxic gases for military purposes, with precise reference to the use of asphyxiating gases during the First World War and the alleged gassing of 700,000 Serbs. This version of the story appeared in a report from the underground resistance movement at Auschwitz camp on 24 October 1941. So this is the earliest. And it says, at Auschwitz, at the beginning of October, 850 Russian officers and non-commissioned officers, Russian POWs, who had been transported to Auschwitz, were subjected to death by gassing for the purpose of experimentation with a new type of war gas, which was to have been used on the Eastern Front. That's the quote. I mean, that's from the underground report from Auschwitz. In subsequent versions of the story, the reason for experimenting on inmates using war gases remained the primary motive. It was experimental. The propaganda requirements of the resistance then invented a new theme, that of the extermination of Jews in gas chambers, which were called Degassungskammer. kammer is, you know, a room or a chamber. Degasum's kammer. This term was a mistake for what should have been Degansung's kammer. Gas infestation chamber. Referring to a disinfestation chamber using hydrocyanic acid gas using a Degesh Kreislauf system, which was standard air recirculation chamber. The combination, now that was a German company, Degesh and Kreislauf. I don't know exactly if that's a name, a company name, or the name of the process or what, but the combination of gas chambers and shower baths, which we have already seen in the letter of 29 August 1942, and which became a recurrent motif of subsequent propaganda, was inspired by two hygienic installations, one still in the design stage, the other in the course of implementation. And he's talking about what they had in the reception building, which is now called the visitor center at Auschwitz, which is that large building. And at the time, they had 19 disinfestation gas chambers in there, and they had showers in there, and all of this stuff for the incoming inmates who were coming in. And this, that is never talked about. Of course, all that has been removed, and they never talk about that. So, well, the first hour, time is up for the first hour, ladies and gentlemen. I got through the most important part of that. And when I come back, I'm going to be talking about Adolf Eichmann and also Mark Weber and a few other, some very interesting. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and you're listening to the Heretics Hour on Monday, January 13th, 2014. I'm now going to talk about the David Cole, Mark Weber video. It's a video now, but when they were on the Montel Williams television show, which came to my attention a couple of days ago, and I decided to make some comments about it. And it started out that I went over to Scrapbook Page's blog, which I haven't been to for quite a while. I just get busy with certain things, and then I lose track of some places that I tend to usually use. Yeah, at times, you know, I follow. But it is run by someone who calls himself Further Glory, and I got interested in a blog he wrote sometime back, you know, about the fifth or sixth one on the page down. But he wrote that David Cole pointed out on this TV show, and, you know, I made a mistake on my mailing announcement that I sent out, and I took it off, but I removed a couple of mistakes on there. But not till after most of them went out in the mail. And, these things that I was had a very distracting morning. And, I cannot find the date of that TV show, that so-called debate or whatever, with those two on the Montel Williams show. And I looked and looked, and, all they have is the times when it's been posted. The earliest date I could find was 2010. Well, I knew it wasn't 2010, but then I thought, well, I don't know, you know, so I had one of those short circuits in my brain, I guess. So I put 2010 there, which of course I think it was back in the 1980s. Or if it wasn't then, it was in the 1990s. I can't put together when David Cole was around and when that was. And you can't find information on the internet anymore by Googling. You Google things and then what you get is not it doesn't tell you what you want. And I couldn't get that date anywhere. But so this TV show was either in the 80s or the 90s, with these two gentlemen. And I think it got more attention in the last few years when people were bringing it back and showing it again than it did maybe at the time. I don't know. I certainly wasn't aware of it at that time. But anyway, Further Glory writes in his blog post, David Cole pointed out on the TV show that both doors in the alleged gas chamber in the main Auschwitz camp opened inward. David Cole asked if the German engineers would have built a gas chamber with the doors opening inward, which would have made it difficult to remove the bodies after 900 people were allegedly gassed in the room at the same time. And he says, I visited the gas chamber in that main Auschwitz camp in 1998 and again in 2005, and I took photos of the doors. It didn't occur to me that building the doors in this fashion would have been totally stupid. But David Cole is right. How did they get the doors open with bodies pressed up against the doors? How is it that the Germans allowed this stupid construction, he asks. And then says the answer is that the alleged gas chamber in the main Auschwitz camp is a reconstruction done by the Soviet Union after the camp was liberated. Actually, it was done in 1947, so it took them 2 years to get around to doing all of that. We all know that, but the story about the doors is something I think that makes people think. And it was very smart of David Cole to bring that up. And what I'm going to be saying about the part of the show that I'm going to talk about is what a poor job Mark Weber did as to what he spoke about to the people there and what a much better job David Cole did. But Mark Weber did most of the talking and seemed to think that he should do most of the talking. I'll just go on with what I've got here in my notes. So when we talk about the doors opening inward, the only answer that the Holocaust people have is that, well, this is not the original building, and this is a reconstruction, and the reasons are this and that. They have some reasons. Guillermo Rudolph said, see, I was talking to him about these things today. As to the doors, he says the Orthodoxy can get out of this by saying that this isn't the original room anyway. One door led to a room that wasn't part of the gas chamber. It wasn't at that time. And the other was included only in 1943 after the building was converted to an air raid shelter. So there's an air raid shelter door that's a very good door, but that was only added in 1943 after they stopped cremating in that building because they had the new ones built at Auschwitz, I mean at Birkenau. And so any people who died at Auschwitz main camp were taken to Birkenau, to the crematorium there. And so since there was no cremations taking place, they certainly weren't doing any gassing, which they never did anyway. So what was there, the morgue, was they didn't need the morgue because they didn't have any bodies in there anymore. So they turned the morgue into an air raid shelter. And then after the war, they turned the whole thing into what they called a gas chamber. Of course, as I've said before, there's nothing to it. But Rudolph says, of course, that amounts to admitting that what's shown to tourists isn't the real thing. So there's no way they can win on this issue because either they've got these doors opening inward or which don't work for gas chamber, or this what they're showing to people isn't the real thing. Well, of course, they're telling people that now. When I was there, they told you that. They told us that, well, they had a big diagram there outside. This is not the original, but it's only been the minor changes that were made don't make any difference, they say, in how it was used. It was still a gas chamber before and after, or they made these, but they show what it was like then and that it still worked for that and blah, blah. So they're trying to get around that. And the thing is that the people who are there looking at it don't care. They don't care. When this guide was explaining this, they weren't paying any attention. They were just anxious to go in there because they thought they were going to see a gas chamber. And that's what they wanted to see. They want to see it. They don't want to be told this isn't real and this didn't happen. They don't want to hear that because they came there to see this stuff. And that's what they wanted to be there. So there's that little problem. But still, I think that if you're talking about it, to bring this up, it's a good point. It's an important point about these doors. Now, I'm saying that when you go into the enemy's camp, which Weber and Cole did when they went on that Montel Williams show, and all those people in the audience are, you know, are amongst the faithful, the believers. There might have been a few open-minded people there. I think there were some, but, you know, this Montel Williams, while he acts real friendly and open-minded, he's got these producers who have a different, you know, have their own point of view. And I noticed that the commercials came on, and of course they're probably scheduled the way they are anyway, but it's like when you have a number of commercials, as soon as you start talking about something where you're making maybe a little progress, you're stopped for the commercial. And when you come back to the commercial, they're on another subject. He won't go back to what you were saying. That happened to David Cole a couple of times where he was doing real well. And then, oh, well, we have to go to a commercial break. We'll pick that up again. Well, they don't pick it up again. They go into something altogether different. And you've lost out there. So, you know, you're going to be up against, enemy forces. And so you have to, I think it's not even a good idea to do that. It's better to have our own places and bring people there to talk to them rather than go into the enemy's territory like going on these television shows. But Montel began this show by, began this program, or the producers began it by showing video of these emaciated corpses from Bergen-Belsen being bulldozed into pits and thrown into pits and so on by the British. But when the show opens, does Mark Webber point out that this was all being done by the British? Because, you know, it makes a difference. No, he doesn't do that. He begins when Montel Williams tells him, what do you say to all that? Look at those pictures, you know, and you're here. We've got a couple people here who are saying that this didn't happen. Well, so Mark Webber starts, and he looks terrible, too. You know, I've never seen him look so bad. He looks like his mouth is right under his nose, so he's got this smashed-in face, and he's got this long black hair that is combed kind of down the side on one side a little bit, like very much like Adolf Hitler. Just only it's combed in the opposite direction, but it's just like Adolf Hitler's picture. You know, when they show pictures or drawings of him, they have his hair coming down, and that's how Mark Webber's hair was. And then he had this little Hitler mustache under his nose. I couldn't believe it. I thought he looks just like, I've seen this before, and I thought the same thing before. He looks like he's trying to, be a copy of Adolf Hitler. And why would you do that to go on television and do a show like this? Anyway, he's acting pretty confident, and he says, now this is word for word. Well, Montel, it's very important to understand that no one says that those pictures are not real. As you indicated at the beginning of the program, that is, he indicated that we thought they weren't real, but we're not saying they're not real. He says the pictures are very real. They're very horrible. They're very tragic. And we've all seen them. We've all heard that 6 million Jews died in the Second World War during the Holocaust. It's very important to understand what these pictures show and what they don't show. Well, he's talking, he's gesturing a lot, and he's acting confident, and he's talking too much like a salesman, I think. And I don't agree at all with him emphasizing that the pictures are real and they're terrible, they're horrible. You see, that's not the approach to take. He should have said, well, this was what the British were doing after they liberated the camp and they were getting rid of corpses, because he talks about how why things were so bad there. But again, he's not connecting with the people in the studio there. He's not connecting with them. They see that, and that's all very emotional and on a different level. He's saying something else here. So he goes on. He says, these pictures were taken by the British when they liberated the camp. The people shown in these pictures, and they're very, very terrible pictures. Nobody denies that. Nobody says it didn't happen. Nobody says it's not true. You see how as far as I'm concerned, he might as well quit right there. He's already lost it all. He's already said this is horrible what's happened, and it's true, it did happen. But then he's going to try to explain how the revisionists see it, and it doesn't really work, because if these things happen to these people, it doesn't matter if they happen in a gas chamber or some other way. As far as I'm concerned, and that's what these people were all saying when they got their chance to talk. But anyway, Webber goes on talking about these people in the photograph. In the video there, these people were victims of starvation and disease. They died in the last weeks of the war. They died as indirect victims. Who cares about that? See, and these people are going to say they don't care. They died as indirect victims of the war. British doctors who were at the camp themselves at the time the camp was liberated, and many inmates who were at the camp and elsewhere, have also confirmed the conditions at Belsen, although certainly not a country club, were relatively good until the final weeks and months of the war. Now, here again, when this guy talks, he always has to give you two or three different ways. So he says, final weeks and months of the war. Why add months? It was the final weeks of the war. And when he says weeks and months, what does it mean? I think, you know, that's where he's not careful in his in his talk, because he does that often. Well, he has to use three or four words for one thing instead of just using one word and keeping it simple. Then he goes on. He's still talking. He says, that was because in the final months of the war, all of Germany, all of Europe was in complete chaos. All the railroads were ruined. It was impossible to supply food, water, and particularly at Bergen-Belsen, thousands and thousands and thousands, he says three times, thousands and thousands and thousands of Jews were evacuated from camps further in the east as the Soviets were coming in and sending to this and other camps that were enormously overcrowded. These people died in large numbers from disease and starvation. But if the policy of the German government had been to exterminate these people, they would have long since been dead, and these pictures would not have been taken. So all the while he's saying this, you know, I mean, he is not connecting with these people, because he's agreeing that people died in large numbers, and he says thousands and thousands and thousands of Jews were evacuated from camps further in the east. So it sounds like so cruel, you know, that these poor Jews are in these camps, and then they evacuate them here, and they evacuate them there, and they're all dying because they, you know, of the bad treatment and so on. And he's not making it clear that it's the fault of the Allies. He mentions that here and there, but they don't see it that way. They see it as these Germans took all these Jews, put them in these camps, and they're responsible for what happened to them. And what happened to them was apparently, you know, millions of them died. It doesn't matter how they died. So I think this is something that we see Weber doing again and again. And what's got me was that he was doing it even back then, when he was supposed to be such a great revisionist at the IHR, not the head of it or anything, you know, working there, writing amongst the other revisionists. People thought so highly of him, and yet every time he gets a chance to pontificate on this or to be the spokesman, he does the same thing. He emphasizes the suffering of the Jews. That's basically in a nutshell what he does. So now he goes on and he says, he tries to make his point, but he says it this way. In fact, the German government policy during the war was a very grim one. Yeah. And it was a very harsh one, and so forth. As I said, again, no one denies those pictures, but those people were not victims of a program or a policy of extermination. That's what Holocaust revisionists say. Now, you know, what good does that do to emphasize that the German policy was grim, harsh, and it caused these people to die, but they didn't have a program of extermination? You know, all these people, when they got a chance to speak, that's exactly what they said was, I don't care what they had. What difference does it make? All these people died, and, you know, they blame it on the Germans. And he certainly didn't help make the Germans' position look any better. And he never, ever expresses anything about Jewish responsibility in any of this. He always portrays the Jews as totally innocent victims. Now there's more about this. He then says, he's still talking, not giving poor David Cole a chance. He says, we know from German documents, we know from German officials during the war. Now it may be that, Montel said a couple of things here, and then he would respond to him. We know from German documents, we know from German officials during the war. Oh, he talked about the final. Oh, yeah. Here's where Montel said, well, but we know that there was a meeting and they talked about the final solution and so on. So Weber responds, they did talk about something they called the final solution to the Jewish question. But of the thousands, millions, tons of German documents seized at the end of the war, that deal with Jewish policy, there is not a single document, a single piece of paper, which talks about or confirms or even discusses an extermination policy. And, you know, I think he is talking above the heads of the audience. It's not that they can't understand what he's saying, but there's just, you know, it doesn't hit them where it counts, you know. Okay, so there's no document that actually says there's an extermination policy. You know, all this makes sense to revisionists, but if you're going to be talking to this group of people who come in a studio audience, it's something else again. So I would say at the least here, he's incompetent in the way he's going about it. Now he continues, what Hitler and the Germans meant by the final solution was forced expulsion, forced from Europe. Now that sounds really bad to the audience when he says it like that. The final solution was forced expulsion. To people, to forcibly expel people, well, that's as bad. You know, you're giving them a kind of a death sentence right there if you're just forcibly expelling them. And you want to expel them from Europe, people feel, take that as a totally horrible thing that the Germans did to want to force these people out of Europe. Because there's no background explanation for it given. And then he says, in 1942, this policy changed. Now, none of this is helpful here. In 1942, this policy changed from one of deporting Jews, uprooting them, he says, and sending them to the East. Now that, you know, that sounds horrible to uproot all these people and send them to the East. And that meant first to ghettos and camps in Poland. And then later throughout the war, they were sent to the occupied Soviet territory. Now that's all correct, but you know, is this what you should be telling these people? That's what the German officials said and meant during the war by this, quote, final solution to the Jewish question. Then he goes on, now at Nuremberg, all of the German defendants in the big trial of 1945-46 all said that they had no knowledge during the war of any extermination program. Again, he's just sticking with the extermination program, sticking with this revisionist line that, well, there was no, the, you know, there's no extermination program, there's no gas chambers. Well, she hasn't actually gotten to that yet. But this does not make an impact on any of these people. Then David Cole finally got to speak. And it was because Montel Williams says he shut up Mark Weber and said, let's hear from David Cole, because he's Jewish himself. And why does he not believe in the Holocaust or whatever as a Jew? And so David Cole talks about the issue for him is the truth in history, and if we're gonna want the truth, or if we prefer to have lies, or because we don't want to search for the truth and all of that. Then he says, because he's Jewish and he has said that he didn't excuse the Holocaust. He only wanted to talk. He only talked about the fact that there were no gas chambers. That was his whole thing. So that was the basis of what they were bringing to this this program. But Cole said, I don't doubt that it was an incredibly horrible thing that happened to the Jews of Europe, and on and on. I guess he went on and on. And he said they died of disease, starvation, and just plain being worked to death. Well, now there's where he's not telling the truth there, David Cole. They died of disease. They didn't necessarily die of starvation except at the very end. Well, they didn't die of starvation except at the very end. And they didn't die of being worked to death either. That's something that is totally untrue, that they were, any of these people were worked to death. Now an audience member says, you know, it doesn't matter whether the intent was there. It happened that 6 million Jews were murdered. 6 million. This woman believed 100% of the 6 million. And Weber starts up again, brings up other victims from other things that are not the Holocaust, brings up slavery in the United States, the Chinese that were slaughtered and so on and all that. See, that also doesn't fly at all. It doesn't matter how many other things happen to other people. And he has to bring up slavery as a terrible thing that happened, maybe because Montel Williams is a black man. And then Cole interjects that the Holocaust has taken the place of religion for many secular Jews, and that the evidence that there was no gas chambers is a lot stronger than that there were. And then a break comes, and then when they come back, they change the subject. And Weber again is trying to ingratiate himself, and he says, once again, we don't say that the Holocaust didn't occur. I hate that line. You know, we don't say the Holocaust didn't occur. If the Holocaust occurred, then something that you can call a Holocaust occurred. And he actually thinks there was. He thought it then, and I'm trying to figure out. I mean, I would like to figure out. I would like to go through everything that I'm not going to, though. I don't have the time to do that. But I would like to go through everything that Mark Weber ever wrote and said and see if he ever crossed that line. That there was, you know, about that there was a Holocaust. He goes, all the work he's done, it seems to me, it might turn out to be that all those articles he's written and so on that people think so highly of, and they're good, and they say good things. But does he ever go beyond a certain line? Does he ever cross it? It's very possible that he never, ever has. And so he says, it's too simplistic, though, we don't say the Holocaust didn't occur. That's really too simplistic. Revisionists say three essential things. And then he starts out, and Montel says, well, what are they? Give us these three things. And instead of giving him the three things right away, he goes on and on. He says, number one, there was no policy or program to exterminate the Jews of Europe. But he has to add, they were selectively persecuted. They were picked out. They were put in camps. They were a victim group, but there was not a policy to exterminate them. And, you know, and these people, they keep showing the people in the audience, and they're looking like, what the hell's the difference? You know, and I'm just thinking Weber is such a loser that he has to keep arguing against his own, you know, his only position is there's no policy or program to exterminate. But at the same time, these people were terribly mistreated, you know, in ways that makes everybody feel sorry for them. And they understand that for them, it makes no difference what the policy or program was. And David Cole then makes a good point that if they were starved to death rather than gassed, it does make a difference already in that our history is wrong. He gets back to the history thing. People seemed to me like they could relate to that, you know, it's an issue of we want to get the truth. It's, you know, because this, some people were saying it doesn't make any difference. He said it makes a difference because we want the truth. If, you know, and he gave some examples of situations where people would want the truth, it would make a difference to them. And then the second reason Mark gave was no gas chambers as a weapon. There were no gas chambers as the weapon of annihilation of the Jews. And that this was pretty good, that all Jewish deaths from any cause during this time, including Allied bombing attacks, are considered victims of the Holocaust. Well, they're trying to, they're going against that 6 million there. Weber then says, because I think, Montel asked him, I believe that no, it was a person in the audience asked him, said, I believe the number of Jews who died in the hands of the Germans was probably 1 million to 1.5 million. I don't think the Germans even had under their control 6 million. He doesn't think. He should say he knows they don't. He should have these facts on hand. But, well, that was it. You see, that's where he said even then, back then, that the number of Jews who died at the hands of the Germans or in the hands of the Germans was probably 1 million to 1.5 million. Well, now he says, based on David Irving, 2 million to even over 2 million. So that's Mark Weber for you. And I thought well, then they brought on the survivors. They had another, you know, about the fourth commercial break. At that point, I skipped some of it. And then I got to a place where I saw that after the commercial break, they brought on, he says, well, when we get back, we're going to have some survivors to talk to you. And they had at least four of them, that were sitting there. I didn't really watch that part, but I had seen it before. It was just disgusting. But so they had four or more of these survivors against the two revisionists, and then all that audience that was against them. So the whole thing just went to hell. But I thought that, considering that David Cole admits that he's not a full-fledged revisionist, he's only a partway revisionist, he did a good job, and he sounded, you know, he brought up some points that would make people think. But I don't think what Mark Weber brought up, while it's standard revisionism, and revisionists understand it, I don't think it made it won over anybody. And so, to my mind, he did more harm than good, and he's always done more harm than good, and that's my opinion of him today, that he's doing more harm than good. Okay, that's all I'm going to say now, because I want to use my last half hour to talk about, I have to hurry here, talk about Adolf Eichmann. And I want to tell you something. I have talked some about Veronica Kuznear-Clark. I don't want to keep this up. I mean, I'm not trying to stir things up with Veronica Clark again, but something came up, and I thought it was important to bring it up on the program, and that is that I was looking through my email, one of my email accounts in the folders for interesting stuff that I might use on tonight's program, and in one folder called Holocaust, I found this email from Veronica Clark that was sent to me back in 2008. I don't think she wrote it just to me. I think she sent it out maybe to other people, or I don't really know. It's just, there it is. And she's using the name Emma Goldman. And I remember there was a period of time when she was using that name for her email, Emma Goldman. And that's what this is from, Emma Goldman. And she wrote a paragraph that she quoted from somewhere else about Adolf Eichmann, which I didn't find particularly interesting. But following that was a couple of paragraphs that she wrote in her own words about her own opinions of things. Remember, this was in 2008 now. And I'm going to quote this. I'm going to read this. She said, Eichmann's show trial behind a glass cage and heartless execution served as the precedent for any and all Jews. Then she, wishing to defect, or rather to give greater allegiance to non-Jews than to their own people. Ah, somebody's interfering with my page here. Darn it. Wishing to defect, or rather to give greater allegiance to non-Jews than to their own people. But after she said any and all Jews, she put in parentheses, Eichmann was half Jewish. And that is false, in my opinion. Where is the evidence that Eichmann was Jewish? Where is the evidence that he was half Jewish? But she adds that in there as though it's a fact. See, this is some of the stuff she does. She's always done it, that I've really disliked. And you can't ask her, I don't know, what I thought about it at the time, though I may not have known one way or the other. But so she then says, Jewry, after saying Eichmann was half Jewish, says, Jewry as a whole is a sick, racist, intolerant, hate-filled, vicious, malevolent, and begrudging people that shrouds its vicious intolerance in a cloak of tolerance. Now, and there's more that's going to show that her dislike of Jewry is because they're racist, because they're intolerant, because they hate other people. Because I'm gonna point out here that the basis of Veronica Clark's thinking is that she wants equality. She wants equality of all people. That's her bottom line, and it always has been. So she says the truth about the Jews, she means, is that they are the most intolerant people in the world. and the most racist, and they will never tolerate any genuine working relationship between themselves and non-Jews. So this is what she doesn't like about them. And then she says, this is why they hate Hitler and the Nazis especially so. Hitler was actually able to reconcile their differences and establish a successful working relationship with these monsters. Well, I do think she's overdoing that, saying that Hitler was wanted to reconcile the differences with the Jews. He didn't. He didn't want to do that. They hate those except for the purpose of removing them from Europe. That was the only purpose he wanted to work with the Jews about. That's why he worked with the Zionists. She says they hate, the Jews, meaning the Jews, hate those who try and help them. So they hated Hitler because he wanted to help them, she says. Just look at what they've done to America. It's time for both Jewry and the Goyim to awaken to the poison of international Jewry. So now she's saying here, too, that good Jews are Jews who aren't the part of the poisonous international Jewry, Jews who aren't the racist, intolerant ones, should join with the Goyim, she uses the word Goyim, to fight against international Jewry. She says, I have nothing but respect for Adolf Eichmann, who she thinks is a Jew. He preferred death as a Nazi to life as a Jew. Stupid. Jewry wouldn't even grant him peace in death. Now this is something to never forget, she says. Well, so I want to comment about Adolf Eichmann being Jewish first. He was the eldest of five children. Now this is from Wikipedia, but it's also the same in Metapedia. He was born in 1906 to a Calvinist Protestant family in Solingen, Germany. His parents were Adolf Karl Eichmann, a bookkeeper, and Maria née Schäferling, a housewife. The elder Adolf moved to Linz, Austria in 1913 to take a position as commercial manager for the Linz tramway. So he lived the first early part of his life up in the middle Germany, or maybe even a little bit to the north in North Rhine-Westphalia. And then they moved to Austria, to Linz, Austria, in 1913, when he would have been 7 years old. His father moved there then, and then the rest of the family followed when he was 8 years old. And in 1916, his mother died, so that would have been hard on him. And his father married another woman who was a devout Protestant with two sons. So the fact that there was, I looked all over and there wasn't any reference to him being a Jew except by, guess who, Christopher John Bjerknes, who wrote an article in 2007, November 28th. And now this email was in 2008. I don't have the date of it. I could find out, but I didn't put it on. Didn't think about putting it on here. And he wrote about it. Now, Hadding has told me, and Hadding's on the program now. Hadding has told me that Hitler was not personally hostile to Jews, but his priority was the Germans. I don't agree with that. I think Hitler was hostile to Jews, and in Mein Kampf certainly shows that. It's not when you say personally, well, he didn't have a personal hatred for every Jew, no, but he was not accepting of Jews in German society. Hadding made a real good point, which I hadn't thought of at the moment, that Eichmann was in the SS. And when you go into the SS, they do a really serious review of your genealogy. And if you have any Jewishness, you know, you are not allowed to be in. So if he had that done and they didn't find any Jewish history for Eichmann, that means he didn't have any. So this whole idea that these people are trying to say he's a Jew, and that Veronica Clark said that, which is very disappointing to think that she's a scholar. And I believe she got it from Christopher John Bjerknes, who got it from Henneke Cardell's book, Adolf Hitler, Founder of Israel, it's in there, and I've got this article, this blog post from Bjerknes where he writes this. And I know that Veronica read that, talked about that very book on a program with Deanna Spingola and was taking it seriously, a lot of what was in it, which is all just a bunch of lies. I mean, everybody was a Jew in this book, this Henneke Cardell. And I've talked about this, and I should really write something up, because just talking on programs gets lost. But I should really write something up that's really sums it all up. But anyway, hello, Hattie.
Hello.
Yeah.
When I called in, you were still talking about Mark Weber. I was just going to say that Mark Weber is also very weak in defending himself when he has to do that. There was a radio program in the late 1990s where Mike Piper was on there attacking not just Weber, but the Institute for Historical Review in general, because, you know, they had this dispute between Carto and other people relating to the Institute for Historical Review. And I phoned Mark Weber at the Institute for Historical Review, and I said, hey, you're being attacked on this radio show. Why don't you call in and defend yourself? Well, that was the worst fiasco I ever heard. He was so bending over backwards to be nice to Mike Piper, who was attacking him.
I didn't know that he was ever got on the radio with Mike Piper. When was this?
I have the cassette of it here somewhere. It was a giant facepalm, because he did the worst job of standing up for himself that you could imagine.
Right.
And the thing is, I think he believes that he's showing that he's not a bad guy by taking this apologetic tone and making all these concessions at the outset. Oh, you know, I'm not your enemy and all this stuff. But that just makes the audience think that he's a weasel.
That's right. And that's exactly the impression I got from this Montel Williams show from back when. That was exactly the way it looked. It appears to me, not that he's trying to he's a double agent or an agent or something like that, but that he's just simply such a weak character, and he has to try to ingratiate himself. And that doesn't work, does it?
That's right, because they think you're trying to pull a fast one. And the people who you really have a chance to persuade, the real hard-headed, rational people, they're not going to be influenced by all that kind of talk anyway. They just want to know the nuts and bolts. So what you've got to do is get right to the core of the issue and state it without any nonsense. And that's exactly what Mark Weber seems to be unable to do.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a good write-up. And so he's no more effective as the head of the IHR. You know, he gave it up. He gave up Holocaust revisionism, saying it wasn't, you couldn't sell it, because he couldn't handle it. He couldn't do it. And he can't do whatever else he's doing any better. You know, he's not doing anything well. So the bottom line for me is that he is just basically incompetent. Because of character flaws, maybe.
That's how Dr. Forreson puts it, that he has a weak character.
Well, let's look at this Adolf Eichmann thing and these people calling people Jews and calling him a crypto. This thing in 2007, I'm sure you are familiar with this Christopher John Bjerknes.
Not
really.
From
JewishRacism.com. Well, he was all the rage. I don't know if he's still around. I suppose he is. I didn't look up to see his current, if he was still currently there, but I don't know, he had a lot of people talking about it and followers, and he's a Jew himself. He's half Jewish. And he will say, I'm so proud. I thought he was kind of anti-Jewish, but he's only anti-Zionist, he was. And one time I heard him on a program, and he was talking about how proud he was of his Jewish heritage, his Jewish side, and how, you know, how commendable the Jews were, all the great Jews and all they've done. And I was kind of shocked. Because at that time, I still thought that he was, you know, somebody on our side or, you know, on the right side or whatever, but not so. And then I learned a lot more about him. But He writes that Adolf Eichmann was a crypto-Jewish Zionist Nazi who, together with other such Jews, attempted to force European Jewry to immigrate to Palestine against their will.
Yeah.
And then right off the bat, he brings up this Henneke Kardell. According to Henneke Kardell in his book, Adolf Hitler, Founder of Israel, Eichmann was a full-blooded Jew. According to Eichmann himself, he was a radical Zionist. And then he pulls up this conversation that Eichmann had with someone named Annie Stern. And it went like this. Eichmann asked her, are you a Zionist? And she said, Jawohl. And he said, good. And I am a Zionist too. I want every Jew to leave for Palestine.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was what they were thinking. They wanted the Jews. The whole National Socialist Party was kind of Zionist in the sense that they wanted the Jews to want to go somewhere to have their own homeland, and they wanted
to help find
a homeland.
You have to understand with this use of the word Zionism, it doesn't necessarily mean Palestine. It can mean Madagascar or Uganda, right?
Yeah, and so they were trying to work on this out. This time it was Palestine that when he said this was, I don't know what day, it's just supposed to have been in 1939.
Yeah, that's about the time when the British decided they didn't want any more Jews in Palestine.
Yeah. So this is supposed to make him a Zionist and a crypto Jew, but to this Christopher John Bjerknes, being a Zionist was worse than being a Jew.
Well, was he a communist Jew?
Who?
Bjerknes?
No, I don't think he's communist. He's just some guy that was...
That's the basic division with Jews. They tend to be either, if they're not Zionist Jews, I mean, that's the way Churchill put it. If they're not Zionist Jews, they're leftist Jews.
He presented himself as anti-Jewish, but it turned out he was just anti-Zionist.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's so many of those anti-Zionists who are going around. I really don't know what his real story is. But then he has another example here about Eichmann saying, Eichmann said in 1960 when he was in captivity by the Israelis, had I been a Jew, I would have been a fanatical Zionist. I could not imagine being anything else. In fact, I would have been the most ardent Zionist imaginable. That was in Life magazine. But you know, that is for a nationalist, you know, that is the way nationalists think. They think that everybody should have their homeland. And so if he were a Jew, he would have been a Zionist. I mean, it all makes sense to me.
Yeah.
I don't see, but this, they use this stuff. And what I'm getting at, I guess one thing is that, that Veronica Clark was falling for all this stuff. She was falling for everything.
She's a very strange person.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can expect straight thinking out of her ever, because she's still claiming that statements from Hitler's 1944 Platterhof speech indicate a change of direction on racial policy, even though I've demonstrated that what he said in that speech was just a repetition of what had been National Socialist racial policy at least since 1933. She's rigid. She's not going to change. And that's it.
Yeah, well, so this thing about, it's so common for people to say that Adolf Eichmann was Jewish or part Jewish, half Jewish and stuff. And yet, you know, I looked all over. There's nobody says that. Except this book by this Henneke. And this is some oddball book. I really need to write it all up. This Henneke Kardell is not a real name, and it's put out by some Polish organization, and it's just a bunch of rumor and hearsay and just made up things. And then this Christopher John Bjerknes, and then what Veronica said. I don't see anybody else saying that, but there are people on the internet who say it, just, you know, people that aren't anybody special. You find it all over. And how do you get rid of stuff like that? you know.
Well, I mean, you can point out the fact that Himmler would not have tolerated his presence in the SS if it had been known that he was a Jew. The founder of the SS...
Well, then these people will say Himmler was a Jew. They say they're all Jews.
Emil Maurice, the founder of the Schutzstaffel, had to resign because under Himmler, Emil Maurice no longer met the standards because he was one-eighth Jew.
And I thought Hitler overruled that.
No, Emil Maurice, if I recall correctly, resigned from the... He had to leave the Schutzstaffel, and then during the Second World War, he served in the Luftwaffe.
Oh, that's right. That's right, he did. I have to, you know, it's hard to get the straight facts about a lot of these stories. And I think that, I don't know if it's me, or if it's the internet, but it seems like the internet is getting worse and worse about having information that would be, you know, that would be truthful. Do you find that? I don't know. It seems to me. I look and I think I'm expecting to find something and there's absolutely nothing there. But the usual junk. Okay, now a little bit more I can say about this. I found it interesting to read about his son, Eichmann's son. He had four sons, and Ricardo Eichmann was the youngest.
Yes.
And he was 7 years old at the time of his father's execution. And after his father, oh, this story about the arrest is just terrible.
Yeah.
I think I'll read that. This son has, he doesn't say terrible things about his father, but he says he's glad they killed him because he wouldn't want to have him around. He wouldn't want to have to deal with them or, you know, have anything to do with them. But he doesn't say it in a nasty way. He just says that, you know, that's the way it was. And he's just glad he doesn't have to, know and have any kind of relationship with his father because he believes what they've said. But this arrest of his, you know, they had no right to do it, did they? I mean, the Mossad, totally illegal, and the rest of the world just sat back and let it happen.
That's right. They kidnapped this man out of Argentina, and yeah, there was nothing legal about it. I want to tell you, I heard an interview, and I actually recorded it, and I have that here somewhere, with one of the Mossad kidnappers named Tzvi Malkin. I have this interview that he gave back in 2001, 2002, where he talked about the kidnapping of Adolf Eichmann, and he mentions that in talking to Eichmann after they captured him while they were still in Argentina, they said something to him about his little boy. And Eichmann went into a total panic over this. He was worried to death that they were going to harm his son. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine what that would do to a man mm-hmm. in terms of getting compliance out of him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Are they, you know, I don't believe a word of what Eichmann said, all that stuff he said. You know, I don't believe any of it's true.
So this Ricardo Eichmann needs to stop being an ingrate, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, he's got a rough deal. They went back to Germany. His mother took them back to Germany. He said his mother never told him about his father. He thought he just disappeared. And when he got into his teens, he started reading about the history and the war and stuff, and that's when he learned about his father.
Yeah.
And he never changed his name, and he went on to school. And he, of course, he didn't remember his, you know, he was pretty young at the time, not that young, but pretty young. And he got this degree. He's I have to look it up, but he's some kind of science thing. And he's working at this institute now in his field. And he uses his own name, and he just has kind of a, you know, he's quiet. But he can't possibly defend his father and have any job. And I don't think that's the reason. I think he really is brainwashed into believing it. He has nothing else to believe. So, but he doesn't say terrible things about him. But, you know, these agents, you know what happened was that a friend of Eichmann's, who was part Jewish, see, a German living in Argentina who was half Jewish, and they became friends. And then it was this guy who figured out who he was, and then he notified the notified the Mossad or the Israeli embassy or something, and they notified the Mossad, and then they worked up a plan and they came, and they just like you say, they just kidnapped him and kept him in Argentina in some kind of safe house for 9 days while they were looking for Mengele. They thought they'd take them both at the same time, but they didn't find Mengele, so then they took him to Israel. And the rest is what we know, but it's truly disgusting.
The thing that I always like to say when people bring up Eichmann and his confessions is that even the Jewish philosopher Hannah Arendt says that things that Eichmann confessed were impossible.
Yeah, it's all just a bunch of... So it fits in. We end the story where we sort of started, or with the Carlo Mantegna book. It's just all these fairy tales, all these lies that they're still passing around, and we need to put an end to them. Hopefully someday we will, and someday soon, too. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening tonight, and we will return on another date.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.